You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
It's definitely the rhetoric from people my age is just that it's an absolute shambles and that it's just kind of a joke because nobody can really discern any of the, like, overload of detail that's going on. I think there's definitely a sense that, like, as soon as anything becomes that nitty-gritty and inaccessible, it's a little bit, I suppose, anti-democratic because it's at the point now that people think we don't know what's going on, least of all do the politicians know what's going on. So I think for, you know, people my age who are of the generation who are, like, truly going to be harmed by this, it's definitely underlying a sense of betrayal, but it's not that heartfelt all the time. When I talk about it with my friends, it's usually just sort of like a rolling their eyes.
So,
what a mess kind of thing.
Right, because it's almost an exasperation that, you know, now it's just going on and it's getting all the, the minute detail. One is frustrating to take on board and understand, but actually too, you have to take that on board in order to understand what the heck is going on in your world, right?
Completely. And I've also found a lot that in terms of like older generations and that sort of element of the public, I tweeted something tonight about how all of the responses to news stories are just straw man arguments, because it's sort of like taking a headline and then just for example, tomorrow our time, so Tuesday night in the Commons, they'll be having a debate over a whole lot of amendments that have been put forward. One of those is by a Labour MP, and it's called the Cooper Amendment, and she's basically making it easier for parliamentarians to extend Article 50 so that they have longer time to settle a good deal. But a mass level of response to that among, like, middle-aged, middle-class, not necessarily Brexiteers, but people who are more okay with the idea of leaving and sit more on the right-wing scale, saying things like that Yvette Cooper is going against her election promises about Brexit, and it's just not at all what she's advocating for. So it's frustrating reading such flippant responses.
Right, but it's because it's difficult. It's such a difficult process, and like what you're saying about the difficulty in understanding that what is actually happening in the detail. Even before the referendum happened, it's almost like I've been reading lots of articles and that sort of thing about actually how difficult it was to understand what people were actually voting for. There was,
exactly.
it boiled down to these very simple, sensationalized ideas about what each side would look like, right? Like a no vote.
Absolutely.
Or a yes vote. What that would look like was boiled down to very, very simple things, which it's not a simple thing. Leaving the EU is not, and it's proving
Absolutely.
To be very complicated, and it is going to take time. And so even that they have to make these amendments and have votes on it, just extending the time, it is going to take a lot of time. But where do we even go from here now?
I know, and it's so true what you say about even when the referendum first happened, nothing was very clear, and that's so dangerous, because if you think about sort of how the debate of the anti-EU rhetoric came about in the first place, it was so motivated by anti-immigration and, you know, all the kind of, like, extremist, fundamentalist, problematic views that circle predominantly around the world at the moment. But now that it's happened, immediately everyone's like, no, economically we can't handle this. I mean, a lot of the reporting it says things like, what will it look like if we have a no deal? And half of the response is often, well, we don't know, and that's why it's so risky. I feel like that's kind of how that whole thing started in the first place.
The no deal risk is what's been talking about at the moment, because the risk, one, is very high, but two, what does it mean to have a no deal? Because that's not getting rid of Brexit at all. It just means Brexit without any kind of transition period, safety, implementations, things like that. What would a no deal look like?
So Article 50, which was, I guess, released on March of 2017, put a 2-year time frame for the UK government to negotiate with EU an appropriate deal so that Brexit could happen smoothly. It was sort of originally trying to make the best out of a bad situation. But the negotiations on that have gone on for so long because foolishly they, you know, didn't think about, I remember that towards the end of last year, Connor for International Series did a piece about Ireland and Northern Ireland and how that border complication throws a real spanner in the works. And so for many reasons like that, the negotiations and parliamentarians' responses to the draft deals have really, really ticked on. So it means that she's running out of time to have a deal sorted out by March 29th, which is set as Brexit Day. Now, if they had negotiated a deal, or indeed if they do still negotiate a deal that works, when we leave on the 29th and then by the 30th, there's supposed to be a transition period where all the what had been mapped out already is implemented safely. So new immigration laws, new trade laws, and everything that needs to change changes safely so that there's not a sudden chaotic we're gone. But now that there is, as you pointed out, an increasingly high risk of there being a no deal, it basically just means that when England wakes up on the 30th of March, none of that will have been mapped out yet, which first and foremost is scary for EU citizens living in the UK and vice versa, UK citizens living in countries of the European Union. But there's also for, especially since I'm in London, which is sort of, you know, the busiest place and where a lot of the imports are coming into, there's fears about food and medicine and how it's going to get through the Dover-Calais port.
Right.
Because there's a risk that about 17 miles worth of queues of lorries and trucks could build up and therefore nothing would come in, which would just be chaos in the city.
And also have long-lasting ramifications just on the day-to-day.
Oh, completely. I mean, they say that this could be the worst economic crisis since the 2008 GFC for the English economy. So the risks are high. Personally, I think the scariest one is the risk of reigniting the conflict of a hard border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, because I think that people who voted for Brexit sort of neglected how horrible it is for people who live close to that conflict. That was the recent past, and it still plays such a significant role in their society.
And hasn't there been a sort of, like you say, a reigniting, or I mean, are those kind of attitudes and racist rhetoric against the Irish, though, that's always been there, that's a massive part of those two countries' history, has that been getting worse though?
Again, it's convoluted given the nature of just how many, you know, like we were saying, minute details that there are to Brexit. But one of the amendments being put forward tomorrow is called the Brady Amendment, which is in line with that sort of racist rhetoric that you're identifying, because part of why Theresa May's draft agreement with the EU that got voted down, part of why it's widely disliked within her own party is that it has a backstop, which means that Theresa May doesn't want to reignite the conflict with a hard border, because if they were to erect an actual fence again, it would be traumatizing and triggering and bring up really like a physical memory. But Sir Graham Brady, who has put forward the Brady Amendment, is not a fan of that backstop and wants there to be a hard border. So the kind of support that amendment gets for sure brings back some of that nationalistic, tired old rhetoric for sure.
Is it becoming too much about that kind of transition period? What about the bigger picture? The transition period will also end, and there could just be that build-up of trucks just at the end of that period. What happens then?
Yeah, and I think that kind of uncertainty is exactly why as I said before, a lot of the answers is that people don't exactly know what no deal is going to look like. But for sure, there were always going to be long-term ramifications. For example, the UK will suddenly have to abide by the World Trade Organization's rules and tariffs for imports and exports instead of being an EU member. And the financial risk for day-to-day consumers of that is very real. Basic goods could increase by a lot, and the finicky details of how to sort of mitigate that harm are very unknown. And, you know, part of people's resistance to the Brexit debates going on for so long is that they say it takes up too much time when England is already dealing with so many issues of economic disparity, particularly within institutions like the national health system, and the negative effects that the, like we were saying about the queues, could have on medicine and access and price. That absolutely could be disastrous. So it's definitely a bit of a waiting game, and I think this is part of the reason why, you know, you could say from a level-headed point of view, it would be good to support the Cooper Amendment and extend Article 50 so we can flesh it out a bit more and it goes a little bit better. But at the same time, the longer that it goes on, the more the uncertainty drags on, and I suppose the worse it feels for the British public, I guess.
So lastly, I just wanted to ask you, how are you getting your information about this? You know, how are people communicating this information, and what's the sort of daily way of keeping up to date with all of it?
For sure. So the presence of like print media is so much more here than I'm used to in New Zealand. Like literally every corner store, every tube station, basically every end of the street has a stand, mostly of the Evening Standard is one of the big newspapers in my area. So I usually pick one up in the morning or whenever I'm passing the tube station. And they're good because they just have like daily updates, especially on Mondays. It's good because it talks about like what briefing has happened in Downing Street that morning and what's going to be happening in the Commons on Tuesday the next day. But otherwise, not so much radio, which I'm missing quite a lot. I feel like since I'm not driving at all anymore, you never really hear it. And TV is sort of dead in like the modern city lifestyle, so it pretty much is just print media now. Yeah.
Is it quite localized in terms of, like you said, in your area there's a certain paper, but is there sort of certain information in those particular papers that pertains to that area?
Sort of. I mean, like England is historically an visibly classist society, so you can definitely tell which demographic each newspaper is angled to.
Right.
For example, if I'm at King's Cross Station, the stories will be, you know, today I was at King's Cross and picked up a newspaper there, and there was a story about how the risk of no deal Brexit would affect British holiday makers when they fly around Europe this summer. Whereas if I'm picking up some of the student newspapers on campus, it'll be more about, you know, immigrating around Europe in the future, because so many of my friends now just don't even want to stay in England anymore.
Right.
Yeah, so it's definitely each newspaper is more tailored to
a certain group
interests than I'm used to.
Trying to keep on top of things is proving difficult.
It is really hard. My research always takes me like 2 times longer than I'm like really ever used to getting ready for a story. It's crazy.
Fair enough. You're doing great research and great work. Thank you, Mary Margaret. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Hopefully.
Yeah, talk to you again soon.
All right.
Yeah.
Bye.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.